Hey, Tacoma. What's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, and even sometimes optimistically. Today, we're going to be talking with Dr. John Perrone. Dr. Perrone's got a long resume of accomplishments in the field of science. He's done the deep dive into both climate science and advocacy for a number of years of his career. He's presently a professor down at Portland State University. He's recently published a book called From Knowledge to Power, The Comprehensive Handbook for Climate Science and Advocacy. The title kind of says it all. His book has two important parts. One part is imparting a good, sound understanding of the science of climate change. Not only it's climate change itself, but things like nuclear power, carbon capture and storage, geoengineering, those kind of things. If we're going to be advocates, we need to be well-versed in every aspect, not because we want to become experts ourselves, but because we want to be confident as we do our advocacy. So it's a real privilege to have Dr. Perrone with us. And just as an aside, his book is available from Powell Books down in Portland, good old Powell Books. You might know that company. It's a great traditional bookstore. If you ever get a chance to get in Portland, just browse around. I think that building's like a block full of books. It's just an exciting place to be. Dr. Perrone's book is also available on Amazon, of course. So let's just jump right in to our conversation with Dr. Perrone. Very happy to have Dr. John Perrone with us today. Dr. Perrone has got a very long resume, and he's an academic, he's a scientist, he's a public speaker, and we'll talk more about this. He's an author. He's from Portland, at least he lives in Portland right now. He's a professor at Portland State University, I believe. And John, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, John. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so let's start off. Could you just fill in the blanks a little bit about who you are, what your interest in climate change, how you got involved as a scientist, those kind of things? Just a 30,000-foot overview of who Dr. John Perrone is.
Sure. My training is actually in biochemistry. Studying the structures of protein and RNA molecules and how they work in cells. But I've always had the bug for environmentalism ever since I was small and fortunate enough to be able to visit the high Italian Alps with my family over summers as I was growing up. So that sort of planted a love of the great outdoors. And after I earned tenure at University of California, Santa Barbara in biochemistry, I started to realize that I could spend some time doing things I actually was really, really motivated by. And that evolved into my interest in climate. And so it's taken me some time to develop to the point where it's now my major interest. But my laboratory has switched over to studying microorganisms that produce methane, which of course is the second most important greenhouse gas. So we study their metabolism and think about how they evolved on the early Earth when there was no oxygen around, and how humans have expanded their habitats in places like, you know, cattle guts and rice paddies and landfills. And so they're the bugs that are producing the methane. We're just giving them a lot of habitat for that they didn't have before. That's why methane is so high in the atmosphere compared to, you know, pre-industrial times. So, you know, the other aspect of my background is I have picked up a couple of law degrees, and especially the Master of Laws in Environmental and Natural Resources Law from the Northwestern College of Law at Lewis and Clark University here in Portland, where I moved about 10 years ago to join the faculties at PSU and Oregon Health and Science University. So that allows me to think with some precision about law and policy, to put it together with the science, and then also to use it in advocacy, where I've been very active with the Citizens Climate Lobby, and also with some teams in Oregon that are working at the administrative level to fulfill the governor's pledge to get to net zero emissions, by mid-century, if not sooner.
Okay, so one of the things that jumps out at me as I listen to your background, I know there's been some conversation in the scientific community about, you know, should scientists just do science or should scientists speak up in the public forum? And it seems real clear that the connection between science and law, especially environmental law for you, has planted you clearly in the school of, yes, scientists should be speaking up. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, science and law, it could still be all academic. You know, I mean, I've published a few papers in these detailed law policy journals that are frighteningly long and detailed, go into things like biodiesel policy and such. But there are more and more scientists. You know, I'd like to mention Catherine Hayhoe, for one, who has just also come out with a great book called Saving Us. And there's definitely a recognition on the part of the scientific community that we cannot continue to stay in academic, cloistered academic places, but rather, you know, share our knowledge. And, you know, we don't expect to have, you know, more sway in policy and politics necessarily, but it is very important for our point of view to be put forward and used by policymakers, because we're not the policymakers, but we are hopefully a group that can inform policy.
Yeah, absolutely. So you just mentioned books. So if you would talk about your book a little bit. The book is From Knowledge to Power, the Comprehensive Handbook for Climate Science and Advocacy. What's the overview on your book? Why you wrote it and who your audience is and what you hope that the book will accomplish?
Yeah. Well, the audience for the book is a couple of audiences, but the primary audience is advocates for United States citizens, laypersons who want to get involved in, you know, finding their place in helping to bring about, a habitable world with a stable climate, and who want to go beyond, you know, just working in their personal lives. It's quite easy to say, to tell people or to, you know, inform them as to what are the things one can do in one's personal life, electrify one's homes and transportation and, you know, eat a diet with less red meat, et cetera. But this book is really focused on a fairly detailed level of education in climate science, going up to date with climate science. That's one leg of it. Another leg of it is policy solutions, where I explain, for example, how the electrical power grid works and how emissions are emanating from industry and agriculture and cities and transportation. So that's kind of the second leg. And then the third leg, and really the most important one, is the advocacy, where I offer a dedicated chapter that's describes strategies and organizations and successful narratives. And then throughout the entire policy portion of the book, I embed descriptions of opportunities and for advocacy and groups that are already involved, and some few stories about what's been successful, so that folks, as they deepen their informational base, can find groups and places to go. And really the premise is that knowledge builds confidence and it builds persuasive ability. And I would say that the combination of confidence and persuasive ability equates to personal power. So there's an empowerment, and hence the title. And so the book is really a resource. It could be read all the way through, or it could be dipped into. And it could be read by experienced advocates who want to polish up on some areas of the field that they might know less about, or it could be read by beginning advocates. I would say it's distinguished from books like Catherine Hayhoe's recent book, in the sense that, one, it's not necessarily for folks who are not sure that they want to get into this business, right? It's if someone is not sure and they're wondering about how accurate is the science and whether that what they can do can really make a difference. I think there's a lot of inspiration to be had from books like Catherine's, from books like Elizabeth Colbert's and other journalists who write about impacts of climate, because it can activate folks caring about the environment. And, I'm not offering a deep dive at the level of a specialization, but I'm filling a gap between the sort of story-based narratives where one can become inspired on the one hand, and, you know, the detailed technical literature, which is not accessible to folks without the detailed without the technical degrees. But in the middle is the sweet spot, and it turns out that sweet spot is precisely the level of conversation that policymakers need, because they're not experts on climate either. And one of the things I've discovered in my advocacy work in Washington, D.C. and in Oregon is, you know, how amazingly little some influential policymakers know, lawmakers know about the climate problem. And so advocates can actually learn by diving into particular areas. I mean, they can learn to become resources for influential folks who make the decisions, whether those are, you know, state lawmakers or business leaders, community leaders, faith leaders, people who are influential. What's the message that they're going to deliver, and how are they going to get that message? And I think that advocates who can immerse themselves deeper in the knowledge about climate science and policy will be effective communicators.
So, yeah, so much there. It's really piquing my personal interest in the book because it kind of sounds like I'm the kind of guy that book is directed at. I'm a lay person, but I've been doing climate activism for a number of years. And a lot of the things that you referenced there certainly ring a bell with me. One of the things in particular, this idea of being confident about the science, I think is so important. There tends to be this thinking that I need to know the science so I can convince other people about the science. I don't see that so much. I don't see folks being persuaded by scientific arguments per se. But when I talk to a group, if I do a presentation, I really love the idea of being confident in what I know because I don't know what kind of question is going to be asked or from what perspective and so on. And so if I do have a firm grounding in the science, I do think that's a must used in the proper way. Another thing that you said there that is kind of new to me, but I can see the truth of it is, I think as laypersons, we tend to think of our elected representatives, the representatives and the senators as like, well, these people know everything about every subject. And it turns out that they don't. And the value of knowing that is that it encourages and empowers me when I want to interface with one of those elected people to think, you know, maybe I do have something to offer them that they don't know already. So, yeah, really looking forward to getting into the book, and I appreciate you doing the comparison with Catherine Hayhoe's book, The Place That Belongs versus The Place That Your Book Belongs. So if I were to sum up your book from what you've said, it sounds to me kind of like, this grounds an active person, somebody who's climate aware, it grounds them in the science and it provides well thought out guidance. And okay, what are you going to do with your activism? Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think that's quite fair. I would just like to add that you're right around, you said the science doesn't convince people. And one of the problems with just leading with a heavy science based narrative, and I address this in the advocacy chapter, although one could argue that, books like Catherine's really expound on this much more thoroughly, which is that, it's important to make a connection with folks and to see what you have in common and where they're coming from and to find the common ground first, right? Because, we're all members of the same community. We might not be in the same political party or have the same religious faith or anything like that. But if we live in the same community, then, we've experienced the same heat wave and the same wildfire smoke. Yeah. As everyone else. And so, we find the common ground. And then once we have the personal connection, that's where the knowledge can be activated. Because once you've got that connection, you have the possibility of something happening. You don't have the certainty of it. You still have different points of view, but you create the ground to be able to have the conversation. It's at that point where the value of the confidence you get and the persuasive ability you get from the book would really come into play.
Yeah, I get that. And I guess I will just add from my personal perspective that sometimes that period of developing mutual interests and confidence in each other, sometimes that's a long drawn out process. By that, I mean, sometimes it can take months, maybe if, the cranky uncle version,
right.
Nothing is going to be changed instantaneously. So I think your guidance is absolutely sound. And I would also say, be patient with that guidance of building the connection. And because if we know something with confidence, I find in myself, it's like, okay, don't you get this? It's so straightforward. Here it is. But that approach for somebody who's not ready for it isn't going to work. So right. Patience is absolutely called for. So I would like to dig into a little bit what I would call practical stuff. And I'm, full disclosure, I'm picking your brain here as a scientist, making some shortcuts for me. Just an aside, I wanted to ask you, I do see that rice paddies show up as a significant source of methane. What's going on there? How could rice paddies make methane?
Well, rice paddies go anaerobic in the sense that the land is flooded and it's a land that's laden with nutrients because you're growing rice. And so that provides a great habitat for microorganisms as well. And so they, you know, they quickly burn up the oxygen by eating all that food. It's kind of like the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico has become anoxic. Like you can't sustain fish life down there because there's so much nutrient running off. Well, so you go down a little bit underneath the water level in the rice paddy and it gets anoxic pretty quickly. And so then that's an environment for methanogens, and methanogens, the organisms we study are the ones that produce methane, simply really just a byproduct of their metabolism. You know, it's not their fault, right? they happen to work in a way that their metabolism generates this methane byproduct, and you know, up it goes and off into the atmosphere.
So out of curiosity, then, is it, well, I guess two things. How much of the methane we're emitting comes from rice paddies? I mean, is it a significant number? And that's question A. And question B is there some other way of growing rice without that happening?
I don't think there's significant other ways to grow rice besides in that kind of environment that would generate methane. You know, the methane and also nitrous oxide emissions from cultivations like rice paddies, but lots of other areas of agriculture, those are among the very toughest emissions. We're not talking about carbon dioxide emissions now. We're talking about these other greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide, which are, you know, number two and number three, or roughly in terms of these well-mixed greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And so given the human population and the need to feed ourselves, it's unlikely that we're going to be able to get back to pre-industrial levels of those greenhouse gases. So this is why when we talk about net zero, the net zero means we haven't gotten 100% reduction. We're not back to pre-industrial. We might be to 90%, where a significant fraction of that 90%, of that 10% that's left, is methane and nitrous oxide that we can't mitigate from agriculture. Given the expanded human population and the need to feed ourselves, we are unlikely to be able to, and that feeding ourselves includes not just rice paddies, but cattle, at least to some level. Of course, we can mitigate that by changes of diet. But we're probably not going to get all the way back to pre-industrial levels of either methane or nitrous oxide. So to the extent that we don't, you know, are we doomed? And the answer is no, we're not doomed, because we can use other land management technologies like, you know, proper soil tilling practices, afforestation, planting new forests, reforestation, where forests have been cut down and can be regrown. And in addition to these natural land management approaches, there are a suite of developing methods, still mostly at the pilot scale, by which carbon dioxide can be actively removed from the atmosphere. And I personally think that those technologies are very, very important to the long-term habitability of our planet for future generations, and that we ought to be investing a lot in developing them.
Yeah, so one of the things that jumps out at me about the notion that because of agriculture and maybe some other things, just having zero emissions and supporting a population is not on the agenda. So that, to me, it makes it even more important that we don't emit the carbon dioxide and the methane, et cetera, that we do have some control over.
Yeah.
So I guess it's fair for me to call myself a progressive. And when I'm talking with I want to talk about nuclear here for a little bit, if that's all right.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm somewhat of an outlier amongst my progressive friends, but I guess I don't have to go there. Talk a little bit about nuclear power, because nuclear power, of course, doesn't emit greenhouse gases. So should nuclear be in our energy future? And if so, what form should it be in?
Sure. Well, I personally think, and I've thought about this in some detail, and clearly there are issues with nuclear power. Everybody knows about them. The record of plant safety operation in the United States is very, very good, but it's not uniformly good all over the world at all times. It's always a hazard there. And of course, we have the waste disposal problem, which is very significant, and the nuclear, the residue from nuclear power lasts many thousands of years. So these are not insignificant objections to the use of nuclear power. But in my judgment, the benefit of it in terms of carbon-free electricity, which is where it would be used for power generation, outweigh those concerns, because the potentially devastating effects of climate change greatly outweigh the concerns, in my judgment, about nuclear power. it's important to recognize, so we have new technologies for nuclear that will be coming online. They're called small modular reactors. They're much smaller. They use less fissionable material, and they should be safer. One design has already passed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission review. So by the end of the decade, we should probably start seeing some of those plants coming online. So we're not talking about building very, very expensive, government-funded, massive nuclear plants of the past. But if we build new ones, they would be this new design. And the reason to keep nuclear power at its present 20% level, which is what is contributing to the electricity grid in the United States now in terms of the power sources, is because wind and solar are, of course, intermittent. And as we grow wind and solar power, which we absolutely have to do, as the first and primary most important thing to be doing, to clean the grid, because then we can electrify from there our end uses like electric cars. But the issue is that the closer that one gets to 100% renewable on the grid, the more and more expensive storage gets because you need to provide the backup. And the problem is right now we do not have cost-effective, widely deployed means of long-term electricity storage on the grid. The only thing we really have is hydropower, where you can create a high reservoir of water and then run it downhill when you want to do that. But that's limited in its geographic extent. So if we keep 20% nuclear and expand wind and solar to say 80%, then the storage problem is much less expensive, and we can electrify from a carbon-free grid. And then over time, if we can solve that long-term storage problem with technologies like green hydrogen, then we'll be able to eventually, you know, replace that remaining 20% of the nuclear. I'm not an advocate for keeping nuclear in there forever. I'm not associated with the nuclear industry in any way. I don't have any particular agenda one way or the other. Other than that, the science informs me that, you know, we ought to be keeping it in the mix. And some of that includes, which is presently in the Build Back Better reconciliation bill, if it gets through, and some of it may actually already be in the infrastructure bill, public subsidies to keep the existing plants running longer so that they don't retire so quickly. And so we keep that baseload carbon-free power in there, right?
So one of the things that I see is that people who are opposed to nuclear power, of course, one of the very common things they point to is nuclear waste and the safety issue. What I see is that, A, there is no source of energy that comes with zero risk. I mean, if we look at deaths from coal, for instance, which we've been perfectly happy to live with for 100 years or more, you know, nuclear is just massively safe. The small modular reactors do sound very promising. One of the things somebody pointed out to me recently was that the Navy has been running submarines and aircraft carriers with these essentially small modular reactors for decades, and they've done that safely and efficiently. So you'd made some comments about a little earlier about carbon capture and storage. And okay, full disclosure here, what I've seen so far, I'm skeptical about whether carbon capture and storage can be scaled up enough to really make a difference. So give me your pitch on carbon capture and storage.
Okay. Well, right now, we're getting a significant amount of emissions from industry, manufacturing, especially cement manufacture, steel making, and fertilizer. Those might be the big three, and there are, you know, a whole host of industries beyond that. And these industry operations are presently not susceptible to being changed to easily run operations that can be made emissions free. In other words, we just don't have the technologies to replace cement, steel, and fertilizer and make them in ways that are clean. We could make fertilizer cleanly, much more cleanly at least, if we didn't have to make hydrogen from natural gas with all those CO2 emissions, for example. And there are budding technologies for, you know, building with wood and changing steelmaking practices to avoid the emissions intensive aspects of those processes, but they're nowhere near being ready to go online. So right now we either use carbon capture and storage on those industry smokestacks or we emit it to the atmosphere. And I don't know. It seems to me pretty clear that We ought to be using CCS, and we ought to be, at least to some extent, subsidizing that, because it's a way of cleaning up the environment as far as the carbon pollution goes. You know, one issue with CCS that makes it controversial is that, you know, the energy fossil fuel companies are often in support of it because they see it as a way to continue to burn natural gas and oil and coal. Well, natural gas and coal for making electricity. And so I think that the policy that we put in place does not have to include carbon capture and storage for power generation from fossil fuel sources, right? We could require that we could have the CCS credit or tax credit apply to the manufacturing processes where there's no alternative, and not apply to, say, natural gas-fired power plants, because to the extent that they do apply there, they're going to take market share away from wind and solar. And furthermore, to the extent that we continue to rely on natural gas for power, we have the problem of the methane leaks, which can certainly be cleaned up to a substantial extent. So a good chunk of methane comes from fossil fuel operations, not as much as from agriculture, but a very significant amount comes from fossil fuel infrastructure. And why should we have to deal with that if we have alternatives that don't require it? So this is tying back to the nuclear power argument. Right? Because if you don't have, you know, natural gas-fired power plants, and you also don't have nuclear-fired power plants, then you are relying very heavily on wind and solar, because hydropower is 7% of the grid now, and there's not much scope to expand it. We've already dammed most of America's big rivers. So, you know, it really becomes important to make this shift happen, right? So I think, in other words, I'm just saying a policy can be designed to keep the CCS contained to where it needs to be in terms of the industries that need it. And the other aspect of this is that the most promising technique for industrial scale vacuuming of the atmosphere, which I'm afraid is going to be important because natural lands can only absorb so much. There's a natural carbon cycle involved. And also, you know, we have to be concerned about things like wildfires that can take all our work and, you know, fire, CO2 goes right back into the atmosphere if you have climate-related fires. So the same technology, the same chemistry that's involved in carbon capture and storage, say, in a cement plant where you'd capture it and bury it, is also used in direct air capture of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. It's the same basic technology. The problem is the reason that direct air capture is so difficult is because the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is so dilute compared to, say, 10-15% of the stack gas from a cement plant. So that's another reason to promote the technology, because it's useful. We'll get economies of scale on the chemistry part of it, and we'll get innovation on how to develop that. And that should feed into the direct air capture technology and make that ultimately cheaper in the long run.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm taking away from your comments about that is, and it relates back to a point you made about your book, and that is the importance of knowledge. Because, you know, I guess I'm probably guilty of this too, of coming down with something, well, carbon capture and storage, bad. But the way you're describing it, you're describing places where it really is appropriate. So we have to be able to make those nuances between the appropriate use of the technology and the inappropriate. Of course, a lot of climate aware folks are very worried that the fossil fuel industry, as you say, is going to say, well, look, we could just capture this carbon so we can keep pulling these potentially stranded assets out of the ground. So nuances call for.
Yes. And, you know, I would just also comment that, you know, we have Glasgow going on right now. It's in maybe this is the last day of the Glasgow COP26 talks. And, you know, we're looking at a significant, you know, half the emissions in the world are now subject to net zero pledges. And that's not half the countries, but countries representing half the emissions are pledging net zero by mid-century. But nobody's pledging net negative, right? Net negative being, say, you know, we go on, let's say we do the very best imaginable transition. We're still going to end up with about 450 ppm of CO2 in the atmosphere is where it will level off. And then at that point, you know, we'll be between 1.5 and 2 degrees, probably, in terms of temperature increase relative to pre-industrial. The impacts will be much worse than they are now. And what are we going to do at that point? Just wait around for geology to take 450 back down to pre-industrial, right? And we could do that. It would take several thousands of years, right? But, you know, we could do that. Or we could develop this technology as soon as possible and actively remove it and safely sequester it in geological canyons where the pilot studies so far have shown that it stays in place, right? Subsurface aquifers.
Yeah, so I think that that's an important point, and I think it's widely misunderstood. I think there's just kind of a popular idea. Well, if we're just reducing our emissions, well, that's a good thing. Well, it's kind of good, but it's far from enough. I mean, even though we've reduced our emissions, if we're adding to the carbon dioxide, things are getting worse over time. And then as the point you make is, even if we are down to net zero, all that carbon dioxide is still out there, and it's going to continue to warm the earth for a long time if we don't do something about it. So I guess I got to say that that your thinking and your data is kind of convincing me. Yeah, there has to be a place for getting carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, even though we stop putting it out there. I think part of my skepticism is from the as you referred to it, the vacuuming the atmosphere. I know there's a plant up in British Columbia and that's experimental for taking carbon dioxide directly out of the atmosphere. And somebody made the point that for that to be effective, it would require thousands and thousands of them all around the world.
Well, absolutely. No, I mean, we are at you know, 1/100th to 1/1000th of the scale that we need to be at.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question that this is something that is going to need a significant amount of investment over a period of decades before it starts to make a significant difference. That's why I'm advocating for, you know, having the effort start now. And you know, the Biden administration is on board with this. I mean, the Department of Energy has a whole initiative around this that Secretary Granholm actually just announced recently. So, you know, in the last few years, really, is when the federal government, I would say, has finally really recognized it and turned the corner on making these investments. So,
well, great. We've talked about a couple, let's say, semi-controversial topics: nuclear power, carbon capture and storage. So let's hit another one while we're on a roll here. What about geoengineering? I mean, I hear talk about spraying sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere. I mean, I think there have been proposals about putting mirrors out in orbit in space to reflect sunlight off, and so on and so forth. So, give us a rundown on your thoughts on geoengineering.
Well, I make a big distinction between these solar geoengineering methods and carbon capture and storage. I mean, carbon capture and removal from the atmosphere and safe sequestration is, you know, a mitigation approach. It actually will keep carbon out of the atmosphere, for example, in a fertilizer plant, and then it can actually go net negative to improve the climate and just take us back to what it was naturally. You know, if we're at 450 and we go down to 420 and 400, and right, this is restoring the balance, the energy balance of the pre-industrial Earth, as compared with a solar geoengineering like the sulfate aerosols, which is really an adaptation, right? It's basically saying, well, we're so hot and we can't think of anything else to do, so we're going to spray sulfur into the atmosphere, sulfur particles, and then we're going to increase the albedo of the Earth so it's more reflective. And underneath that, we can burn all the fossil fuel we want, right? And then the oceans will continue to acidify, because that's not a solution for ocean acidification. It's not a solution for anything other than keeping us a little cooler in the short run. Now, this is going to have massive planetary-wide climate and weather effects, right? And so it's going to require a terrific degree of international governance were it ever to be put in place. So, you know, I don't think it, you know, just reflect a little bit on the quality of international governance at the moment and the fact that there is no there's no possibility for binding agreements. We tried that with Kyoto Protocol and it bombed. And now we have a bottom-up approach with starting from the Paris Agreement, which is based on voluntary contributions, because it's the only way that works is to try that level of persuasiveness. But when we're talking about geoengineering, we're talking about the requirement for, you know, we would have to solve our international political situation before I would feel comfortable with that approach. And it doesn't solve the problem anyway. Right. So I'm concerned about it, though, because there are a lot of folks who are interested in it. And there are, you know, very smart young scientists at MIT, for example, who are now getting PhDs in this field. And the more people get invested in it at that level, the more it's like they want to see it work, right? And I'm concerned about that. I don't think we need to go down this road.
Yeah, well, you do a good job of making your case there. In fact, I interviewed a couple of scientists from the University of Washington who are researching, I can't remember exactly what the technical term is, but basically what it is putting ships out in the sea, spraying seawater up in the air to increase the water vapor content, right. Et cetera. So, yeah. It does seem like even worse than a Band-Aid approach, and I think your points about international cooperation are well taken. I mean, country. If we actually did start putting sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, some countries would do better, but some countries would do a lot worse. And how do you deal with that? So, change in direction here just a little bit. Talking about, see, I think it was Yogi Berra who said making predictions is difficult, especially about the future. So. Just wondering, do you ponder at all where we're headed in terms of degrees of warming over the next, let's say, between now and the end of the century?
Well, sure. it's hard to be engaged in this work without thinking about that. I don't think my personal opinion about where we're likely to be in the year 2100 is of particular interest. I would just say that we need to have all hands on deck to stay at least below 2 degrees, which is certainly eminently doable if we have the political will to do it, using only established technologies, using only existing legal authorities. In fact, we have what it takes to do it. We just have to want to do it. Then I could add that, and it's not my opinion. This is the consensus coming from the climate modelers who are projecting the roadmaps for the energy transition. That given the advances that we've made in the past decade in terms of renewable energy, we've significantly bent the curve already. This is not a message you hear as often as the message, say, from Glasgow that, you know, we're not doing enough. We're not doing nearly enough. We need to do a lot more. And so it's confusing that there are two messages, really. One is that we need to do a lot more. There's no question about it that the present policy scenario, if we meet all the pledges, leaves us at 2.8 degrees centigrade. That's what the United Nations has just been telling us in the last month. Obviously, that's not remotely good enough. We need to be at least below 2, if not 1.5. On the other hand, it is also true that, you know, scant decade ago, many projections were in the 4 to 5 degree range. And there is a pretty good consensus now that we're not going to be there. And that's a very good thing that it, you know, every increment of temperature makes the impact of climate change that much worse. So it won't be the worst case scenario. It may still be very bad. It will certainly be very bad if we get to near 3. But I just think it's good to recognize that there's been some progress because it should give folks hope that if we've made some progress, well, we can continue to make progress. We're not in a doomsday situation. You know, I really have a problem with doomsday writers, especially if they write well, like David Wells, for example. He writes very well, so he's persuasive, right? But he's written a doomsday tome in his book, The Uninhabitable Earth, which I really feel is not helpful to the situation. Where we are.
There's kind of a balancing act there, and I think you've pointed to that to an extent. The task ahead of us is huge, but we don't need to despair. There's evidence that we are making progress, and you know, I do know that a lot more people are way more people are talking about climate now than they were even 2, 3, 4 years ago. So, and we do see tipping points in the political system as well as in the natural environment. We've seen states adopt legislation that they've been adamantly opposed to for years, and all of a sudden, bang, there it was. So I'm going to hang on to the bifurcation that on the one hand, we've got a lot of work to do, but on the other hand, maybe we'll do it. And so I appreciate your interjection of optimism there. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was just going to add that Washington State is a great leader in the process of decarbonizing, right? The market-based carbon fees that have just been passed in Washington are, you know, it's great to see that the governor has won Took a long time, but he won.
Yeah, I feel fortunate to live in the state of Washington. It as an activist, it does bring up a question, because so many of our elected representatives are climate aware. And so if we want to be active, who are we going to be active with? So one of the answers has been with local politics, but the other is to join with national organizations that target swing states and things like that for our activism. I feel grateful to live in the state of Washington. Of course, Oregon is doing a terrific job too. And I can share in that a bit, because I grew up in Oregon. I grew up down near Medford, Oregon, went to the University of Oregon. So yay, Oregon, yay, Washington. So we're getting close to the end here. One of the things you mentioned, you're an activist. I believe that's a fair representation in Citizens Climate Lobby. I also am involved with Citizens Climate Lobby. And talking about policy, why don't you talk just a bit about their approach of putting a fee with a dividend on carbon emissions and your sense of how effective that would be if enacted?
Well, I think it would be tremendously effective. I mean, study after study from modeling groups, like Resources for the Future, for example, has just come out with another one, comparing the different possible policies that could take us to net zero by mid-century that would be embodied in the Budget Reconciliation Act that is still being debated, and the carbon price is still on the table there. And they're showing that an aggressive economy-wide escalating carbon tax on fossil fuel companies will drive the energy transition more effectively than any other single policy. And because it underpins all the other policies, and maybe part of what's not understood about it is that because it's so general and because it works across the economy, you can't really pin down, well, where is it working? Is it working here? Is it working there? And we can do studies and show, yes, a lot of the emissions savings in the first decade are coming from the power sector. But that's not necessarily what folks hear. They just kind of hear this market-based approach and can't you pay to pollute? Well, you could, except that if you do, you'll go out of business because you'll have to pay so much, right, with the steep tax that others who go to another technology that doesn't emit carbon are gonna clean your clock, right? So it's that front end, right? That front end of working through the market. They pass the cost on to anyone who has to buy fossil fuel, all the companies buying fossil fuels, right? And then, you know, why should they continue to do that if they haven't? The other side of it is what do you do with the revenue? So against all the other policies are spending money to solve the problem. This is raising money to solve the problem. And then you can take the funds and invest them in solutions. And you can take some other part of those funds and return them to low-income households, for example, or return them to, you know, fossil fuel communities who need to transition. There's lots of creative approaches for how to spend the money. That should be a massive benefit to this policy. It's really can be head scratching. Like, this is just, it just checks the boxes that you need to solve the problem, and frustrating that, it's been so difficult to convince folks to enact it. I would just add this point here. Fossil fuel companies claim to support it, claim to support carbon taxes. And it's come out recently that they don't really believe that it would ever pass, and they're only doing it as a front, as a manipulation to pretend for a policy that they would never, they are sure will never pass, right? But the other thing that's happening with that, that I think is not very well understood, is that some elements of the progressive left, which also oppose carbon taxes, I think on grounds that it's just, you know, it's an ideological anti-capitalist ground, that is where the opposition is coming from. They see the fossil fuel company supporting, you know, saying they support the tax, and they think that anything a fossil fuel company can support is bad. And so the fossil fuel companies know that. And so not only are they sure that the policy will never pass, but they help make it not pass by dividing the left, right? Now, most progressives are supporting the policy now. Some still don't, right? They didn't in Washington State in 2016. Yeah. And they haven't at the federal level. I mean, many have, some have not, enough to block it, right? So now it appears as though there is a recognition and a support for it, and we're down to whether Senator Manchin will support it or not. And he's, of course, on the fossil fuel side. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, I guess fingers crossed, because the evidence that you point to, I've seen that evidence too, that putting a price on carbon and then using the money from that to mitigate climate change and to support communities and support transitions out of fossil fuel and so on is a very effective thing. And I've been scratching my head for a long time about why it hasn't gained more traction, but it does seem like we have an opportunity here. So I'll keep my fingers crossed on that. I do know, as I've done presentations and have talked about a carbon fee and a dividend system, that the pushback I've gotten has been almost universally from progressives. Going in, I thought, well, you know, it's going to be conservatives that don't like this because they don't like taxes of any kind. But a surprise about the progressives. I do appreciate your perspective on the fossil fuel companies, too, in terms of their Machiavellian, right, is the only word I can think of, approach.
That's
towards.
Exactly what it is.
Yeah. So, so anyway, I guess so. We're about finished up here. What anything else you want to bring up, and maybe just some last words to the activists, the advocates out there, and then we'll be done.
Yeah, I dedicated the book to all the young people in my family and others in my life, other young people in my life, and to my young students. And I just want to underscore that this huge question of intergenerational equity and how important it is on a moral level that we leave future generations with a habitable climate. That's a moral imperative. And I don't know of anyone, regardless of their political orientation, that would ever speak against that. Right. And so it's just the awareness that what we're doing now is damaging the future still needs to penetrate a little bit further. But I think if there's one thing everybody can agree on, it's that we shouldn't be messing up the earth for the future generations. Maybe that's a point of agreement that we can think about how to develop better in our messaging.
Yeah, that's a great message, and I really appreciate it. So once again, your book is From Knowledge to Power, the Comprehensive Handbook for Climate Science and Advocacy, due out November 30, the way I understand it. I wish you really well, not only with the book, but with the important and critical work that you're doing. I know that you devote us an enormous amount of energy to it. And on behalf of myself and other folks that care about the climate, thanks so much for that. And thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, John. I really enjoyed it.
So there you have it. I'm really looking forward to reading Dr. Perona's book. And this episode, like all other Climate Talk episodes, will be archived at the KTAH website. You can check it out there, or you can go directly to ccltacoma.org. There's a link there to connect you with archives of Climate Talk. You can send me an email anytime, John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. I'll look forward to hearing from you. So here I am, reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.